Thanks, Ghana. Good afternoon, everyone. I too, in acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, and thank you, for Murray, for the welcome that you gave, or the acknowledgement you gave. I was reminded of Kate Grenville's absolutely wonderful novel, The Lieutenant, and recognising that probably the first housing crime to be perpetrated in this country was the white people who sailed into the harbour and dispossessed the Aboriginal people of the harbour. In talking about crime-free housing, I'm going to be trying to bring together information, ideas, reflections from quite a range of projects and involvements that I've had over 20, 25 years. So the first part is rather about reflecting on social perspectives on crime and neighbourhoods and public housing, a little bit on some of the state of theory and ideas going on at the moment, and particularly things that are engaging me and some of my observations. And then I'll sort of change tack a bit and give you some early findings of a project that I'm working on, which is called Working from the Ground Up, WFGU, for those of you who want to call it something. I'll just give a little bit of a run through some of the thinking that's been going on about crime and public housing neighbourhoods, both in Australia and internationally. Certainly the evidence is that there are higher levels of crime in public housing neighbourhoods in the UK, in the USA, in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, comparable countries. But when we go on a little bit, I'll try and deconstruct that a bit to have a look at what that really might mean. And there's plenty of, I've only given a few of the references there, and I have many more if anybody really would like to email me about a bit of a reading list on this. The evidence seems to be that much of this is street crime, public crime, particularly juvenile offending, and we'll come to that when I talk about the second part of my presentation. Certainly drugs and family and domestic violence seem to be, the forefront of the kind of levels of crime and thinking about crime that one sees in the literature and in thinking about public housing, neighbourhoods and crime. It was mentioned a few minutes ago that perception is extremely important, and it is. Perception of crime, people perceiving that they are not safe and that they are at risk of crime, thinking that they certainly might have been a victim of crime, but if they haven't, the perception of crime is a really important driver. In the public housing neighbourhood involvement that I've had over a very long time now, I'm involved with a community development project which has been going on in Waterloo, Redfern, and then in South Coogee, and at Menai, and at Namajira Place, which is down near La Perouse. I've been involved in that for something like 16 years. It's a partnership with housing and our university and public housing tenants, and more recently with a project that we're doing with public housing tenants in Matraville and Maroubra, that there is often emerging in people's minds of nuisance, annoyance, very difficult behaviour and crime. Now, I live in Newtown, and I can tell you at 2 a.m. in the morning, the nuisance and annoyance I really wish was crime, and despite the fact that I really want to close prisons down, I wouldn't mind seeing most of those people who are out the front of my place making a noise off in prison. But that is not a crime. Often the perception of crime is around the public nature of it, out on the street where it's observable, where it's affecting people directly, and there is a not only a physical element to it, but an in-your-face element to it. And that's particularly an issue around juvenile behaviour. So I sort of want to put that in a the frame of our thinking, that we are not here talking about murders every week, and we're not talking about serious crime every day. There is some of that, but what is mainly happening here is this notion of lack of safety, and that this has a lot to do with this the physical presence. And so we have to, I think, anyway, we can think of crime at a number of levels when we're thinking about crime in neighbourhoods. There is the individual problem of crime. So it's an individual problem of the person, the individual, or the family. There is a lack of social or moral responsibility. There's poor parenting, there's selfishness, there's individual impairment, which lead to individuals doing crime or doing things which are seen as criminal, and of making people feel insecure. Then there's the neighbourhood effect. Now, many of you might have heard of that term, neighbourhood effect. It's a growing term used in the literature and in research around what is the effect of living in a neighbourhood which is disadvantaged or which has a lot of crime or which has poor physical facility. And there's a lot of challenge around this, and I'm not going to go there today, but it's a very interesting and important area. But this covers stuff like the underclass thinking that Wilson used quite some years ago and has now resiled from that, doesn't use that term anymore, but the thought that there is this underclass that live in these that neighbourhoods like this. Neighbourhoods of poverty have more crime is sort of the general view, that there is a lot of risk proneness in these kind of neighbourhoods, and of course there's a lot of stigma. So when you go for a job, you don't say that you live in suburb X, you live in the next door suburb or a suburb a little way away. This has been well documented in work for many years about the nature of stigmatising particular suburbs or areas. And public housing estates or public housing areas where there are large numbers of public houses often get framed in this way. And then there is, of course, the social and structural level of thinking about crime. That is, that crime can certainly be caused by policy, by the way we frame, the way in which we look at people, the way in which we place people. How we think about particular things that people do. And most certainly, there has been a criminalising of lots of behaviour. You just have to think of drug taking. Not in favour of drug taking, but it has been criminalised in a way that it wasn't before the late 1970s, 1980s. It's not to say we shouldn't be doing something about it, but it's to say that certain behaviours can be criminalised by social policy and by the way in which we think. That's a sort of critical criminology approach. So I am going to talk a little bit about inequality because I think that's a really important aspect of this social structural concept of crime. Certainly poor resourcing has a lot to do with crime, and people who are extremely poor may do crime because they're poor. Not only, of course. And exclusionary policies are certainly part of supporting a framework of expecting that particular groups and particular areas are going to be crime prone. So what have some of the social policy responses been to these views of crime? Well, we've had Galina has told us about a couple of these, but there are intensive management approaches. That's both in corrective services, in the police, in public housing, and in the way in which we try to, as a society, manage people who are difficult to manage. So intensive management. Certainly increased community surveillance. There's an area that I know very well, which is probation and parole. there has been a very strong increase in the level of intensive management of people out on parole. And so this is to the detail of turning up at 10 o'clock at night on a Saturday to check whether somebody is with someone they shouldn't be with, or they're drinking, or to give them a urine test or something like that, so that there is this sense of managing. And of course there's the behaviour orders. Another approach to this, which often goes hand in hand, but often then is in conflict with the earlier ones, is an increase in social cohesion approach. So we already heard increasing the social mix. This is the salt and peppering, or the moving around of people, shifting problematic residents away. It's certainly effective. You get them out of where they were, but of course often you then just shift it to somewhere else. So that's often a short-term thing. Not always. It can, in fact, with certain people be helpful. And facilitating community development, and I'll be talking a lot more about that in a minute. And of course there's the cross-agency partnerships, MOUs, increasing agency presence and resources. Just to comment on that, I've observed MOUs for a very long time now because they're very involved with a lot of the areas that I research in. And I know they've moved on from MOUs. They're called something else now and they're a bit better. But your question goes to the heart of this. Who then takes responsibility? MOUs are all well and good. Everybody can sign on the dotted line. Everybody can say, yes, that's our responsibility as a government department or an agency or an NGO. But who then really takes responsibility to make sure that something is happening? And that has often, in my view, been the failure of these kind of cross-agency agreements. There are some examples of excellent approaches to this, and those are where an agency does, or where there is usually a case manager, that is someone who does take responsibility and then does all of the connecting or networking. So perceptions and experiences, well, views of crime of course are highly subjective. Something that I don't view as a crime, someone else will view as a crime. Something that I don't think is insecure, someone else will think is insecure. So, again, as a couple of people have mentioned already, fear is a really important aspect of that. And one of the things that you do see in the development of when you have community development, you do have stronger community sense, is that crime that fear reduces. And so it might not be that crime literally reduces, but it may well be that perception and feelings about it reduce and change. And a very good example of this is the evidence that Victorians feel safer than people in New South Wales, despite the fact that New South Wales spends double the amount on the criminal justice system, double the amount on prisons, put away almost double the number of people in prison, and that crime levels are not all that different. Now, so perception and the way in which we think about where we live and we think about our communities are really important. Of course, I couldn't possibly give a talk without saying something like this. The more we imprison people, the more reoffending we get, because prison is criminogenic. People who go to prison often reoffend. In New South Wales, over their lifetime, 70% of people who go to prison once will go to prison again. So that's not the answer to reducing crime. It may be that people need to have a prison, but that's not the way to reduce crime in neighbourhood. I'll skip on to just a couple of things about framing the next part of what we're doing. So we've already mentioned the importance of intersectorial or cross-cutting or layered or synergistic work. And I can't emphasise that enough, really a very important aspect. So that integrated policy and practice is essential when trying to develop these kind of layered, intersectional, cross-cutting ways in which we do things. We cannot work in silos, because that means that these things don't happen. Have to recognise the power differentials between people. People in public housing, the people that that I have been involved with or talked with or been working with for a very, very long time, no matter how nice the housing worker is, recognise the power differential. So that's sort of sitting there at the back of everybody's head. We must address social inequities, and that may be the best way to address crime. It's a lateral aspect. And if anybody has read The Spirit Level, which is a fairly new book on inequality and why the more equal societies are, the better things are and the less crime there is, if you're interested in this sort of stuff, go and read it. It's a fantastic book, and it's an eye-opener. Really important that we recognise that it's not just specific projects and not just working on a specific physical thing or a specific social thing. There is this broader context in which we all live and in which people in public housing estates live. Just some concepts to introduce you to. Some of you will know these, but some of you won't. The idea of a negative cycle or a tipping point is pretty important. And the more concentrated public housing becomes in terms of the disadvantage, which of course is happening, despite housing's wish and need and attempts to dissipate that, housing has a serious problem because there are more people who are falling into their bucket who have complex needs, mental health problems, people coming out of prison, single parents with children who have disabilities, so people who have drug issues and so on. There are more of these people coming into public housing than public housing has possible numbers of housing for. And so this concentrating is almost an impossible thing for housing to stop happening. Now, some of the work that people like Wilson and Tony Vincent from here have done have shown that there can be these points at which things become so lacking in social cohesion and so lacking in social capital that the community, the neighbourhood, doesn't have the capacity to support or deal with these things. And so this is a concept to keep in your mind as I talk a little bit about community development in a minute. From other work that I do, I'm doing a big project on mental health and cognitive disability in the criminal justice system, and that's revealing a number of really interesting things about this. Of course, the majority of these people go into public housing when they get out of prison. A majority of them need public housing support and need multiple levels of support. Now, what I am seeing in this is that what this group of people, and there are a large group of people, almost 40% of people in prison today will be in this group, and probably more, that they, from a very early age, have begun living in a different space to what we think of as a community space. So there's a liminal, marginal social space, community, criminal justice social space, in which these people live. And when they get out of prison, they don't move into an ordinary community space that we know. They stay in this kind of space. It's a space in which they were never integrated into the normal community or the ordinary community. It's not normal, but the ordinary community. Most of these people have been caught up in juvenile justice from an early age, 10, 11, 12. So, and they have very, very long police contacts, long record with police. So that is something to keep in mind, that this is a group who use public housing to a great degree. Other ways that I've been thinking about public housing recently has been that actually public housing is now an institution. We've got rid of the other big institutions that we've had, psychiatric institutions and and disability institutions and big homes for foster children and so on. We only really have two big institutions left. That's public housing and the prison that deal with housing people over any length of time. So I think that we have to think a bit differently about the nature of housing, and I've sort of obviously got lots of thoughts on that, which I won't go into now, but just putting it in the back of your mind. We cannot bypass the importance of someone having or feeling a sense of some control in their lives. And that's a really important aspect of public housing, which can be built up through social networks. All right, so just for the last couple of minutes, I'm going to talk about the Working from the Ground Up project and just give you a bit of a sense of what that's revealing in its very early stage. And note that Working from the Ground Up is not about crime. It's not about reducing crime. But it, in the same way as the other work that we've been doing, it's a lateral outcome in a way that there's a whole range of things that happen. Fear lessens, and there's a stronger feeling of ownership of space. So this is a project, an ARC project, that I'm working with two colleagues here in social work. So it's a cross-university working partnership. And we have a partnership with Housing New South Wales and with New South Wales Health and with TAFE. And we're looking at living in South Maroubra and Matraville neighbourhoods. If you're going out on Anzac Parade towards the prison, straight after Maroubra Junction, on the left is the South Maroubra, and then a little bit further when you get to Duffy's Corner, on the right is the Matraville community. And so this project is looking at urban renewal, and someone asked, what evidence do we have? Well, that's one of the things we're doing. We're gathering evidence for what community development actually achieves. So it's looking at urban renewal, community partnerships in social housing neighbourhoods, and exploring what community initiatives work to create opportunities to improve health and well-being, which of course includes reducing crime, increasing safety, and reducing fear. Very briefly, South Maroubra and Matraville are two quite large housing areas. They're not really estates, because we sort of have a discussion with housing about what are estates and what aren't, but they're fairly large groupings of public housing, and they have really all the hallmarks of public housing compared to their neighbours that are private housing, lower incomes, much higher rate of older people, high Indigenous population, high unemployment rate, high single-person households, high one-person households, very low internet connection and very low motor vehicle. So the hallmarks of a community that doesn't have a lot of money. So the way we're working and the way community development always works is to hand things over to the people, and that the people are the ones who say what's important, what things mean to them, and what they want. They don't want people to come in and tell them what to do and say, have we got a solution for you? Here's another steak knife. They want to have their say. They want to say what they think. So we start off by asking them, one, do they want us there? And then, what's it like to live here? And what do you want to see happen here in your neighbourhood? And so we've done a lot of surveying and talking to people, and of course using LOAT languages, and we're also currently doing surveys of young people in both those areas. And good things about living in the place. Now, some of this might be rather interesting to people, because one often thinks people can't wait to get out of housing neighbourhoods, particularly if you mightn't realise it, but the South Maroubra one is the Lexington Place neighbourhood, where there has been a lot of sort of attention, police attention and crime attention. By far the majority of people in our survey are attracted to living in their neighbourhoods. They feel loyal to the people in their area. They want to work together to improve the neighbourhood. They plan to continue living there. Now, I have to say some of that is because they know they can't go anywhere else. And you'll see that there's that's evident in those who would like to move out if given an opportunity. But it's not a huge number. They believe their neighbours would help them in an emergency, and they feel safe walking around during the day and in their home at night. So very high level of those things in that neighbourhood when one thinks of the public perception of those neighbourhoods. But, 30%, 39% would like to move out if they were given the chance. 50% don't visit their neighbours. Now, a lot of that has to do, in my view, and in our view, our team's view, with a number of things. One, there's a significant number of older people. There's also a significant number of single people who have a variety of mental health issues, and certainly some of those are things like anxiety and concern about where they live. Some of them can't speak the language of the people next door to them. So there are reasons possibly for that. I mean, half of them don't think the buildings and grounds are well maintained. They rarely invite their neighbours home, and they don't feel safe walking around at night. Now, 63%, well, you know, I think probably a lot of people in lots of places would not feel safe walking around at night, but it's certainly higher than in the leafy suburbs. But what do these suggest? I think they suggest something different to what people often think about public housing. By far the majority like their public housing neighbourhood. They like where they live. They feel safe most of the time. And there is a great reservoir of interest in and willingness to make their neighbourhood safer. The top five things they like about living there: the beach, not surprising, close to everything, their neighbours, the public transport and the shops. People said to us when we were talking, walking around, talking to them, well, why would I move? I mean, you know, people pay $2 million to live next door to where I live. Why would I move? It's a fantastic place. But the things they don't like, the behaviour of young people, crime and vandalism, which is almost entirely about young people. There's quite a lot of people who are very lonely, so few social contacts and connections. Drug and alcohol use, again, not entirely, but largely around young people. And disputes between neighbours. Well, if I asked you whether you had a dispute with your neighbour one day, you might have. But quite clearly, crime represents about 70% of what people don't like. And we have already deconstructed a bit of what crime means. So, without doubt, crime is around almost entirely juvenile behaviour in that area. Not entirely, because there are some drug perception, and that might be the case, although the police that I was talking to said they weren't quite sure that there were any real drug dealers living there, but there's a perception that there are some older people who are drug dealers living in the area. But what the crime is very much this public stuff. Now, there is quite a lot of, as there is in many places, domestic violence, and that tends to be hidden. And if I had time, I'd go into that a little bit more, but I don't. There have been quite a lot of crime prevention and reduction strategies over the past. They've been hotspots, so, you know, they've been sort of coming in and trying to fix the hotspots. But there has been very little long-term social resourcing. There's a little bit, but not much. Now, this is the kind of thing that you see in their local paper, right? This is the Southern Courier. And so we see it's mob rule at Lexington Place. Michael Daly said, the same old problem. Parents won't take responsibility for their children. Now, this was on one of Channel 9 or Channel 10 last year. You might have seen it. You know, and do you know what they showed you on those? They showed you 3-year-old video of kids running sort of rampant. Now, there was only one evening of that. Not to say that the kids are, you know, many of the children are very difficult and their behaviour is problematic, but we are talking to those young people and we are getting a different story from them about their experiencing, what they're experiencing, what they want, what they would like to see and what they want to do. So, what would make a difference? Residents want to see more support, particularly for families and individuals who are finding it tough, more activities for young people, better maintenance and relationship with housing, less crime and vandalism, which relates to the top few, improved parks and public spaces. Now, I won't spend time on these because we haven't got time, but this is just to prove to you that we really did talk with people and those are their real quotes. Although there's some pessimism, residents have a lot of ideas and place-based solutions themselves. What they are suggesting is more space and activities for children and young people, more security in and around buildings and streets. You're absolutely right that security is important. Most of the three-storey walk-ups, you can just walk through, upstairs, knock on a door. There's no barrier, there's not even a fence around the three-storey walk-ups. There's no sense that this is my space. So certainly there are big elements of built environment there, but I'm only here to talk about the social stuff. Change policing practices. What they really were interested in was that police would just be a bit more responsive when they were called. Now, in our observation, in fact, police seem to be pretty responsive. So it's not quite clear what that was about. Certainly, more community events, they love. We now have barbecues every week or so, and people just come out and spend time when they've never been out in the green area before. Make the area look better, better relationships with housing. So, because crime is seen largely as youth delinquency, the residents actually are more focused on improving amenities for young people and people with mental health, complex needs and themselves as the way forward, and young people to be controlled via these kind of things, the inclusion and activity. So the people themselves want to see something different happening. So community development looks like something that's there for the long haul, for a long time. People are there, working together, doing stuff, working on what residents want, linking and supporting local agencies, that they're relational and respectful, and that these are all examples of what then change. So, I go back to my very first couple of slides. The residents' solutions fit very well with some of those concepts I had at the beginning. They are arguing that tipping points need to be countered by social supports and resources, that the building of social networks and groups is part of that, that we have to listen to residents and residents participate directly, that we address the long-standing, we together address the long-standing marginalised space that's lived in by many people who live there, and that one takes a lateral approach and resists the fly-in, fly-out, and particularly just the straight law and order approaches that we saw in the Southern Courier headlines. Thank you.